Welcome to the Friday Night Clive podcast with me, Clive Payne. In this podcast, we look back at the amazing charities, organisations and people we have chatted to over the past few months, all of whom have interesting and important stories to tell. Time now to talk about sepsis, and my colleague Ken Francis talked to Dr. Ron Daniels from the UK Sepsis Trust earlier on today, and here's how he got on.
Each year, more than 245,000 people are affected by sepsis, with 48,000 deaths in the UK each year. But what is sepsis, and how can it be spotted, and can it be treated? On the line now to tell me more is Dr. Ron Daniels, BEM, who is the founder and COE of the UK Sepsis Trust. Ron, thank you very much for taking time out to talk to us here at Black Country Radio.
Not at all, and good evening.
What is sepsis and what causes it?
So sepsis is the way the body responds to an infection. So it's always triggered by an infection, most commonly something really simple like a water infection. It can be pneumonia, it can be a problem in the tummy. It can be something as simple as a cut or a bite or a sting. But in sepsis, the body's immune system goes into overdrive, and if we don't stop it, that's what causes organ damage and death.
How can we spot sepsis, and what are the symptoms, and does it affect different people of different age groups?
So the first thing that we need to do is to make sure that we're all aware of sepsis. We've heard of it, that we know if a loved one or ourselves are deteriorating with an infection, we need to think about sepsis. And if we're worried, we can phone 111 and just ask that question, could it be sepsis? Now, right now, of course, we've got the COVID-19 pandemic that is on everyone's minds quite rightly. But if someone's deteriorating, whether it's COVID-19 or another infection that can give rise to sepsis, we still need to ask for help. If we're really worried, there are six symptoms to look for, and they spell the word sepsis. S for slurred speech or confusion. E for extreme pain, that's disabling pain in the muscles or joints. P for passing no urine, no water in a day. The second S is for severe breathlessness. Now, obviously, breathlessness is a symptom of COVID-19. But again, whether it's COVID-19 or another infection, if your breathing is so laboured that you can't talk, or you simply can't do a basic task like putting your clothes on, then you need to get help and go to A&E. I, for it feels like I'm going to die, and people really do say that. And then the final S, for skin that's mottled or discoloured or very, very pale. Any one of those six with an infection, whether it's COVID or not, go straight to A&E.
You talk about the skin. This is an outward sign of they've got sepsis. Is there any sort of anything really that's going to show up on the skin that we can sort of pick up on straight away?
Absolutely. So we've all heard about that rash, and we live in fear of it, particularly parents of young children, that doesn't fade under a glass. And of course, if that occurs, go straight to A&E. But in sepsis, we see different types of discoloration of skin as well. The skin, the extremities, the hands and the feet can go very, very, very pale. And that's abnormal, and that's worrying, and it's straight to A&E. Skin can take on a different colour. It can look purplish or bluish. It can have almost a marbled effect on it or a mottled effect on it. And any one of those skin colour changes are as worrying as the rash that doesn't fade under a glass. And this applies to adults and children as well. Children display similar symptoms to adults, but very young children can't communicate them. And when we talk about that first symptom in adults, slurred speech or confusion, in very young children, this is about a change in behaviour. It's about a child who won't even show interest in a tablet or a smartphone. It's about a child who can't be made to smile. Again, that's really worrying, and take that child straight to A&E.
How can we treat sepsis, and is the treatment always successful?
So in the UK right now, if you develop sepsis as an adult, you have an 80% chance of survival. That's better than it used to be even just a few years ago. And one of the changes that's been made is a package of care that was developed right here in the West Midlands, which is called the Sepsis 6. And this package of care that we developed is now saving lives not only in this country, but in 40 other countries around the world. What it is, it's the basics of care that any junior health professional can deliver. So a busy junior doctor, a busy junior nurse can do the Sepsis 6. It's about giving a bit of oxygen, taking some blood tests, giving fluids into the veins to restore the circulation. And it's about giving the antibiotics. Doing these six simple things can double the patient's chance of surviving if we do them quickly.
Is it age-related? I mean, I'm a guy of 58, and they say I'm a very fit person of 18. You know, does it affect either way? Does it, you know, somebody who's very, very fit, like an athlete, or somebody like myself at my age, does it just happen to anyone?
So the honest answer is yes, sepsis can affect anyone. Now, it's more common in people who are older, and it's more common in very, very young children. But anyone in the middle can develop sepsis, yes.
40% of sepsis survivors suffer permanent life-changing after effects. What are these effects, and how do they affect a person?
So we describe these as post-sepsis syndrome, and we see it in people who've been in intensive care with sepsis, but equally we see it in people who've managed to avoid intensive care, who've been caught a bit earlier. As you say, 40% of people have one or more problems, and we broadly group them into cognitive problems, which might be poor memory or poor concentration, poor decision making, psychological problems, which range from being a little bit panicky through to post-traumatic stress disorder, and then physical problems, which can be obvious. Some people can lose limbs or lose fingers and toes as a result of sepsis, but a lot of people have more subtle physical changes, most common of which is really disabling fatigue and pain.
So it can really make you tired afterwards. Is this, you know, ongoing, or does this sort of fade off as time goes along?
So we expect people who've survived sepsis to mostly return to normal within about a year of having the illness. And that surprises people. People expect, and their families and their employers expect, that when they come out of hospital, they're going to be right as rain straight away. And that couldn't be further from the truth. And again, now we've got COVID-19. Because these people are developing some very similar features to sepsis, and they're spending a long time in intensive care if they become ill enough, we expect them to have exactly the same range of problems. And that's why our support group at the UK Sepsis Trust has now opened its doors to survivors of COVID-19 who've been bad enough to be hospitalised.
That's amazing that you're actually combining the two, COVID-19 and the sepsis. Tell us more about the Sepsis Trust. Why did you set it up?
So I set it up, I was a young clinician working in intensive care. It was back in 2004, and actually we've just had the 16th anniversary of his death. It was a young man called Jem Abbott. He was 37, he lived and grew up in Streatley Village near Sutton Coldfield, and he had a couple of young kids, and he had a lovely wife, Karen, and he was just had everything to live for. He developed sepsis after a minor operation in the community. He ended up being missed by a couple of health professionals in the community, and then he came to Good Hope Hospital, and there we failed him as well because we didn't think about sepsis and we didn't give him antibiotics. And we had to tell his wife, Karen, that he was not going to make it. And you can just imagine walking down the hospital corridor, following this woman and just watching her shoulders start to judder, knowing that she knew that I was about to take her into that relative's interview room to tell her that her strong Jem was not going to make it home, and that she'd have to go home and tell Tom and Emily that Daddy was not going to come home, all from a condition that I knew he didn't need to die from. That was the motivator to getting started on this journey.
So it was a personal thing that really kicked you off to make you get going on something like this?
Absolutely. And what we now have is a brilliant young charity. We've only been registered since 2012, but a brilliant young charity that critically provides support to people affected by sepsis, and I've said we're now extending that support to people affected and hospital by COVID-19. We educate health professionals and we give them the tools like the Sepsis 6 to save lives with. We work with the professional bodies and with government to make changes, and we raise public awareness. And doing those four things saves lives. This is not about extremely costly research. This is just about communication.
Communication and education goes a long way.
Well, absolutely. And when you've got a problem like sepsis, where the care is very variable, people present to healthcare too late, some health professionals historically haven't been thinking about it, haven't thought it an emergency, it's communication and education that can fix that problem.
Tell us about the Just Ask, Could It Be Sepsis campaign?
So this was a campaign that we developed back in 2015, and it was in response to our sort of pressure on the government made them finally agree that we needed to do something and we needed to make the public more aware of sepsis. So we landed on the then Secretary of State's desk, Jeremy Hunt, this campaign, Just Ask, Could It Be Sepsis? And he was blown away by it, and he just pushed the button, gave it the green light right there and then. And so we now have this messaging. We have it in city centres, we have it on television programmes, on soap operas, we have it on the side of ambulances, because it works. It's simple, it's empowering, and it reminds the public that if they are unwell with an infection, then they need to just ask, could it be sepsis?
You've managed to get it into soap operas. How did you manage to do that?
So it varies according to the soap opera. So, for example, BBC's Holby City, and I will cover the other side as well, but BBC's Holby City, we simply phoned them up, spoke to some of their medical advisors who were absolutely minded to support the sepsis campaign, and we said, can we have some of your posters in your, some of our posters in your hospital, just like they are in real life? And they put them on the programme. We had 27 consecutive episodes, 14 seconds on average screen time. It was brilliant. The next one that came to us, we've done The Archers, we've done Call the Midwife, but ITV's Coronation Street took this so seriously. They had us editing scripts for 3 months. They had us on set for a week, making sure all the hospital scenes were filmed correctly. They really wanted to get this story right. And, you know, these programmes, they go out to millions of people, and it's a fantastic way to get the message out there.
They took time to actually make sure that it was as like a real-life situation.
Absolutely, absolutely. So I myself was on set for the entire week, making sure everything was done properly. They sent every single script to us well in advance of filming to make sure that everything was being done right. You know, these programmes, whichever channel they're on, they have no interest in scaremongering and sending the worried well to A&E. So they wanted to make sure everything was spot on.
It's nice to know they're actually doing their research properly. It's not just a another storyline, if you know what I mean. They're actually pumping out a really good message.
Absolutely. And I've been massively impressed with all of the soap operas that have covered stories. They've all acted hugely responsibly.
Now, fundraising, as ever, with every charity, is at the heart of your fight against sepsis. How can somebody fundraise for the UK Sepsis Trust?
Well, if you'd asked me that question a few months ago, I'd be giving you a very different answer. But what they can do at the moment, we're about to launch a fundraising campaign that's going to be social media driven. So one example of that is we have an annual event called Cycle for Sepsis. Obviously, we can't do that in real life this year, but what we will be doing is encouraging people to be undertaking activities in their homes, if they're allowed to, in the next month or three, in their offices and so forth. But we're going to have very easy to activate stuff. People are sitting at home right now. We've got a West Midlands-based charity, a West Midlands-born charity here, that is now going to be providing support to people who've been hospitalised with COVID-19. So look for us on social media. You're sitting at home. Most people don't want to be sitting at home. They want to do some good. You're saving on your travel money. Give us your travel money that you'd normally be spending on getting to work. Give us your lunch money that you'd normally be spending and make yourself a sandwich instead. There's lots of easy things that people can do. So have a look on our website, sepsistrust.org. Follow us on social media, at UK Sepsis Trust, or I'm at Sepsis UK, and engage with us, see what we can do. And then watch this space into next week, because there's going to be a big fundraising effort launched.
Yeah, I mean, from when you set out to what's happened over the last, so we say, 2-3 months, life has changed completely. And so that you're looking at new things basically via the internet to get the message out to people.
Well, life's changed for everyone, hasn't it? And I'm still an intensive care clinician, so I know as well as anyone how horrific this illness can be. And it is absolutely right that people stay home, stay safe, look after themselves. As I think it was Piers Morgan said, we're not asking you to go and fight in the trenches. We're asking you to sit on your sofa. And it really is going to save lives. You know, as a charity, any responsible charity is not going to just ignore COVID-19. Everyone, everywhere is stepping up to the plate to do what they can. We've had companies feeding health professionals for nothing. We've had, you know, manufacturing industries in our brilliant region stepping up to the plate and seeing what they can do to help with ventilators and so forth. Our charity is no different. What can we do to help people affected by COVID-19? Well, we already support people who've been in intensive care. That knowledge and expertise is transferable, so let's offer that to survivors and their families.
You talk about COVID-19 now. I'm just backtracking off of sepsis. A lot of people I've seen on social media are saying things like, you know, let's talk about the survival rate and not the number of people who have died. I feel that to let people know what is actually happening, as in like the number of deaths, is the best way of doing it. Because if you tell the public that, say, 80,000 people have survived it, they're going to think it's over.
Well, absolutely. And what we don't want to do is to give people a false sense of security, because behaving right now, listening to Public Health England, listening to the government, is absolutely the right thing to do and will save lives. You know, we've heard tragically today of the young nurse from Walsall Manor Hospital who's died having contracted coronavirus. This is not just older people who are dying. Yes, your chances are higher if you're relatively healthy and relatively young. You've got a greater chance of survival. But I think it is important we let the public know that if you get COVID-19 and you get it badly enough to need a ventilator, however old you are, your chances of surviving are less good than in a normal bacterial pneumonia.
You also have volunteers for the charity. You know, how can people get involved in volunteering?
So our charity, like many, runs on volunteers, and we have a brilliant volunteer coordinator called Francesca who makes sure that they can do what they sign up to do. So right now we need, if you need it, for example, health professional volunteers. So you might be self-isolating, you might have some other condition that makes you vulnerable, so it's not safe for you to return to the NHS. Pick up the phone, you can help our support team support people affected. If you're not a health professional, we need funds. We've got to grow our support team. We're expecting thousands of people to need our help over the next few months, and we need funds to come in. So get onto social media, get onto website, get in touch with us, find out what you can do to organise activities within your network. It might be your Facebook group, it might be your business. If you've got a business, can we get your staff doing something for us? There are huge opportunities. And once it is safe for us all to venture out, then we need people to be on the streets, be at stands, raising awareness.
How does the charity support those who have suffered from sepsis?
So we have a team of experienced nurses. Most of them are intensive care nurses. We run a 24/7 hotline. We now have the support nurses phoning individuals who need our help and supporting them with telephone calls, with advice, with signposting to information. They can advise on anything from diet through to a gradual exercise program through to psychological support. When we're not in the middle of a COVID-19 pandemic, we also have 32 support groups that meet face-to-face in towns and cities around the four countries of the UK. And that provides a huge lifeline to these people. So we support hundreds of people every single month, and we can make the difference between them sitting at home thinking, why me? And them becoming motivated to get back out into the community, into their jobs, supporting their families and valuing life.
How would I find one of these support groups?
So again, it's go to our website, go to sepsistrust.org. There's a section on get support, and there you'll find all the information, including our 24/7 hotline.
Dr. Ron Daniels, we thank you very much from Black Country Radio for coming on this evening and talking to us, and we very much appreciate what you're doing and your time put in.
Thank you so much and have a great evening.
More importantly, good luck, because you're in one of those wards where you're going to be really on the front line for the National Health Service.
Absolutely. And it's what we've trained for, and it's what we signed up for, and it's the right thing to be doing. And I can reassure everyone right now that certainly in intensive care within Birmingham, we have enough PPE right now, and we're just about coping with the demand on beds.
We thank you for that. We really do.
You are listening to the Friday Night Clive podcast. If you like what you are hearing, don't forget to subscribe to get the latest installment at blackcountryradio.co.uk/podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts from. Now, on with this week's episode. We're talking now about Parkinson's disease. And did you know there are 145,000 people in the UK with Parkinson's, but in excess of 1 million people in the UK are affected by Parkinson's, either by living with it or as a friend, colleague, or family member of someone who is. Now, Parkinson's Awareness Week began on the 5th of April and will go out with a bang, according to the Parkinson's UK people, tomorrow with World Parkinson's Day 2020. Now, this is a chance to help people understand Parkinson's better. I'm joined on the line now by David Swindells, who is the Area Development Manager for Parkinson's UK. Good evening, David.
Hello, Clive.
Thank you very much for your time this evening. First of all, tell me what Parkinson's disease is and how is it diagnosed? Why is it called a disease? Because it's not contagious, is it?
No, it isn't. And we tend not to use the word disease these days. We class it as a condition. Because you're quite right, there's been some confusion over the years by using the term disease, some people thinking that it was contagious, but it isn't. Parkinson's is a neurological condition and it's progressive in its nature, which means that it will get worse over time. There isn't a cure for Parkinson's, unfortunately, though we're working really hard to try and find one, and we invest an awful lot of money into research, but unfortunately we still haven't got a cure. There is medications that we that people with Parkinson's can take, but unfortunately that doesn't cure it and it doesn't slow it down. Mm-hmm. All it does is mask the symptoms for a while. So it is a condition that doesn't have a cure. But although we're working very hard through research to try and find one, we also don't know the cause of it. Although recently there's been some research which is suggesting some potential causes, but we don't know for definite yet what it is.
Mm. So what's the average age of a person that then gets diagnosed with Parkinson's? Is it young people or you know?
It tends to be the majority are older people over the age of 55. But it's wrong to think of it as an older person's condition because many people younger than that do get it. There's been some recent estimates that something like 1 in 20 people who are newly diagnosed with Parkinson's are 40 or under. Mm. So it does affect a significant number of younger people. And obviously, if Parkinson's does affect younger people, it comes with a whole raft of other issues as well.
Such as
they may have young families, they may be working, and that sort of thing.
I'm with you. Now, I mean, is it hereditary? Because some things are, but, you know, does there have to be a family history of it? Or is it fair to say it's just one of those things that can just suddenly occur?
Yeah, we really don't know. There has been some research into whether it is hereditary. There may be an element of that, but we think it's not the main issue. Mm. And it is something that does seem to occur just in some people, and we really don't know why.
Now, my friend's dad has it, and he's had it for, I think probably a couple of years. And actually, if you saw him, generally, he looks perfectly well. I mean, he is in his 70s, to be fair. And I was quite surprised when I was told that he had the condition, and he controls it with medication, but he does seem to sort of tire quite easily. Is that one of the associated symptoms with it? Or, you know, if you think somebody has got Parkinson's, how do you know? What are the obvious signs?
The thing with Parkinson's is there's no one simple test that can be done to prove that somebody has Parkinson's. It's a diagnosis that's made based on symptoms. So really it needs to be somebody who is a specialist in Parkinson's really needs to make the diagnosis. Because they're used to what the symptoms are. It's what they call a symptomatic diagnosis. Mm-hmm. There are some common symptoms that people would recognize with Parkinson's, such as tremor, stiffness of gait. There could be
what's stiffness of gait, David?
Symptoms with the facial expressions.
What's stiffness of gait?
I'm sorry, yeah, it's where people's mobility reduce. Mm-hmm. And they may freeze, they may find walking difficult.
Understand.
So all those things can be early symptoms. Things like handwriting, if your handwriting starts getting smaller, that sometimes can be a symptom. But I have to stress, if you've got any of those symptoms, it could be something else, and it may well not be Parkinson's, but there are some indications that it potentially may be Parkinson's, so you're as well to go and get that checked.
Yeah, it's important not to make sweeping assumptions. I mean, for people perhaps who, I don't know, might have, I suppose, a fall or an accident or something, is that a trigger?
No, not necessarily, no. It may, if there's situations where people are falling regularly, that might be an indication that there's something going on with their mobility. But the fact that they've fallen doesn't mean that that will trigger Parkinson's.
Okay. Now, I mean, when somebody has a stroke, for example, that can affect, you know, one side of the body or both sides of the body. Is it fair to say with Parkinson's then, you know, as you said, the impact factors really are quite immense and it's not necessarily tailored to one side of the body or both?
Yes, that's right. That's not to say it would never indicate on just one side of the body, but it could equally be both sides of the body. So it's not necessarily going to act like a stroke.
Okay.
I couldn't say to you that in general that would happen.
Does the sufferer experience any kind of pain? Because I don't think my friend's dad did.
Well, they can, yeah.
Oh, right.
Yeah, people with Parkinson's, the thing is to say most people recognise the tremors. They think of the tremors, difficulty in movement, lack of facial expression, things like that. But there's about 40 other symptoms of Parkinson's alongside those. And some of that can be muscle spasms, pain. There could be sleeplessness. It also can affect things like people's mental health. They can become anxious. They can become depressed.
Right, okay. So there's lots of what I would call latent symptoms as well as sort of primary symptoms there. So I suppose the common sense thing is that if you think that you may have something like this, or if your loved one has, I guess it's a trip to the doctors in the first case. Assuming the doctor then arrives at that conclusion that it is a Parkinson's, what are the treatment options? Because my friend's dad balances it with medication, but are there any other things out there?
Yes, there are a few. Medication tends to be the main one. Medication and also what we call self-management. So things like medication, lifestyle, exercise is really important for people with Parkinson's. Medication doesn't slow the condition down. Mm-hmm. It will mask the symptoms for a while, but the condition will still progress.
Okay.
Exercise. Some studies have shown that exercise, if you take it up early on and keep exercising, that does slow the progression of the symptoms down. So exercise is really important for people with Parkinson's.
And I assume a healthy diet as well.
Yes, yeah, absolutely right.
Which goes for anything,
really. Yeah, it's that good quality lifestyle. But if you do get diagnosed with Parkinson's, then the neurologist will put together a treatment package. There's also specialists around to support who are Parkinson's nurses, for example, who'd be able to help, physiotherapists. Parkinson's UK also have a helpline where you can ring and get advice in terms of things like exercise, healthy lifestyle. You can speak to Parkinson's nurses or employment and benefits advisors. So I would say if ever you are diagnosed with Parkinson's, it's worth getting as much information as you can. And also locally, for instance, in the Black Country, there are a number of local groups that meet regularly. They provide information and advice, social activities. They also run exercise groups. So it's well worth getting in touch with Parkinson's UK and finding out the details of those local groups.
Sure. Now, I mean, people sometimes get Parkinson's confused with dementia. Well, my understanding is that they're two completely different things. But can one antagonise the other?
Well, yes. That's one of the later symptoms of Parkinson's, is that people can develop dementia. having dementia doesn't mean you will get Parkinson's. And similarly with Parkinson's, it doesn't go that you definitely will get dementia, but there does tend to be a higher prevalence of people with Parkinson's that do also have dementia.
So how can a person find a doctor who is knowledgeable about Parkinson's? I guess, is there information on your website in relation to that? Because not all GPs are specialists in that, are they?
There is. I mean, the best thing to do, first of all, is to see your GP.
Mm-hmm.
And the GP will then refer you on to a neurologist or to another doctor that's got a special interest in Parkinson's. That's really the first step. And then from there, it's important that you take advantage of any multidisciplinary teams that there are, as we said, physiotherapy, speech and language therapists, physiotherapists, and they'll be able to advise you about your lifestyle, how to keep yourself healthy and well. The thing with Parkinson's as well is that medication has to be altered regularly. So if there's changes in your condition or if you become unwell because of another reason, it's as well to get in touch with the Parkinson's nurse or with the Parkinson's helpline to discuss what the medications are that you're on and to get some advice as to how best that could be approached.
I think it's also important to point out that if you are diagnosed with this, it isn't the end of the world, because as I say, going back to my friend's dad, he's a living example. You've just said, he manages it with his medication. It's balanced quite frequently. I can't remember the frequency that he goes and sees the Parkinson's nurse. But he goes on to live, you know, a very happy and, you know, pretty jolly well healthy lifestyle in his village. He's the village vicar. So he's always busy. And, you know, I think he manages it very well.
You're right. And you're absolutely right to make that point, that people do manage their symptoms very well and lead very full lives. It's not the end of the world. And a lot of people I speak to with Parkinson's, and I ask them what's the most important thing for them in managing their condition, just about all of them say it's having that positive mental attitude, staying active, keeping your mind active, and that helps them to maintain their lifestyle.
It's true, isn't it? You know, a healthy mind and an active mind and an active body as well. Now, you're coming to the end of Parkinson's Awareness Week and to World Parkinson's Day tomorrow. What have been your key reflections of the week so far?
Well, I think one of the things that's come across is that this year it's been very different because of the coronavirus, of course. Your local groups in the Black Country, they often put on lots of events during Parkinson's Awareness Week. They have stands and things like this and give out information. Of course, this year it's been very different because people haven't been able to go out and do those things. But what we've done is joined up with Cure Parkinson's Trust, and we put together a map of the country, and we've asked people with Parkinson's to put onto that map their story of what Parkinson's is, because our theme for this year is get to know someone with Parkinson's. And so all those stories, people have logged onto that map, and it's really interesting to look through that and to see how people have coped in your local area. So it's well worth going onto the website and having a look at that. And also, if you know someone with Parkinson's, or any of your listeners know people with Parkinson's, it would be good as well if they could be encouraged to go on that map and have a look and to enter their stories, really. So for this year, I think the highlight for me has been that it's been led very much by the Parkinson's community. Usually what happens is that we have a national office at Parkinson's UK and we'll take the lead with the Parkinson's Awareness Week. But this year, people with Parkinson's have really said, no, we want to lead it. We want to tell people our story. So to me, I think that's been a really positive thing for this Parkinson's Awareness Week.
Sure. Now, as we said, tomorrow is World Parkinson's Day. Given the coronavirus restrictions, what form will tomorrow take as World Parkinson's Day?
Yeah, so sadly, we are sort of very restricted with it. And our major drive this year has been that the website with doing the... we're doing that online map that people could look at. Mm-hmm. But we're also encouraging people to talk to folk if they know they have Parkinson's and find out a little bit more about their condition. As we were saying, if you know 66 people, the chances are you will know someone with Parkinson's or affected by Parkinson's. And so if they do, we'd hope they perhaps give them a ring or... Zoom them or do any video chats with them just to try and find out a little bit more about them as people and how Parkinson's is affecting them.
Just remind me of your website address then, David, please.
Yeah, it's www.parkinsons.org.uk. If you just put in Google search Parkinson's UK, it will come up.
And is there a telephone number? Because obviously not everybody has access to the internet or is in a position where they can use it.
There is. And the telephone number is 0808 800 0303. So it's 0808 800 0303.
Lovely. That's super. David Swindells, Area Development Manager for Parkinson's UK. Thank you very much indeed for talking to Friday Night Clive.
No, thank you, Clive.
Thank you. That's your lot for this episode. You can catch the show live every Friday night on Black Country Radio from 8 p.m. If you love our podcast, please subscribe by heading to blackcountryradio.co.uk/podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts from. See you very soon. This is a Black Country Radio podcast, presented by Clive Payne, production by Andy Caddick and Alex Griffiths.